You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
Although Gloria Steinem is well known as a writer, lecturer, editor, feminist activist, she's not generally thought of as an avid traveler. In her first book in over 20 years, she offers a candid account of how her early years led her to an on-the-road kind of life, traveling, listening to people, learning, and creating change. The paperback edition of My Life on the Road has just been released by Random House. I'm very pleased it has brought Gloria Steinem to our show. Welcome.
And I'm pleased too. Thank you.
You estimate that you've spent at least half your life on the road?
Well, I started young because my parents spent half of their time in a house trailer. And I thought, of course, that I had rejected this form of living. You know, we think we're not going to be anything like our parents, and then it turns out we are. So it took me a while to come back to it, but because of being part of a social justice movement, it just seemed natural.
When you were young, did you assume that you would settle down at some point?
Yes, because I thought you had to. I thought it was obligatory. I mean, if I went to the movies, people were living in houses with picket fences. And for women especially, I thought you were supposed to get married and have children and settle down. So I just assumed that it was going to happen, but I kept putting it off. Just not right now.
Adventure and travel have been overwhelmingly a male prerogative. Don't women travelers traditionally come to a bad end? You mentioned Amelia Earhart and Thelma and Louise.
Yes, I do think that part of the reason I wanted to write a road book is that it is seen as a male genre, even though when they do DNA studies, they discover that women were the travelers more than men, partly because they were going to marry somewhere else or whatever. But anyway, they're probably more distant from the place they were born than men were. But it's perceived as a male genre. Think of Jack Kerouac.
Mm-hmm. Well, you have On the Road in your subtitle here, just as Jack Kerouac did, but this is a very different kind of book.
Yes, the one thing that we have in common, I realized after I started writing this book that I would have to explain why I was on the road all the time but didn't drive, because the form of movement travel means that you're on a bus or a train or a plane and you're going to a campus or a union or a meeting or something. People pick you up, you get to talk to them. And so I launched into a fierce defense of traveling this way, because if you don't drive, the moment you leave your door, you're in a different world. You're in a bus or a taxi with other people. But then I discovered that Kerouac didn't drive either. Mm-hmm. So I felt justified.
You say that you learned a lot about India because you didn't drive.
Yes. In India, of course, communal ways of travel are way more common. And that turned out to be very important. I mean, being in old English railway cars, there are women-only dormitory cars, rattletrap buses, you know.
Could you speak to people?
It's a communal experience.
You don't speak Hindi.
I don't speak Hindi, and Hindi is, of course, supposed to be the national language, but actually there are 14 major languages in India. It's a lot more like Europe. So English is also a national language. So you get to either speak English or kind of make do with English and a little Hindi.
Did you generally travel alone? You were married for a while, and there are no mentions of traveling companions in this memoir.
No, when I began to travel, I was always traveling with a speaking partner, because I was way too scared to speak by myself. You know, I had been two things in my life: a dancer and a writer. And I realized that both of those are, you know, you don't have to talk. So I really, really did not want to speak in public and had never done it until I was in my middle 30s.
And you talk about having to get past that fear of speaking in public. How did you work it out?
Well, I never would have even tried if I had been able to publish what I wanted to publish about the first explosions of the women's movement, but the editors I'd been working for were not interested. And at the same time, I was getting a few speaking invitations because I was a writer. and it seemed the only way to talk about this excitement, but I was too afraid to do it by myself. So I asked Dorothy Pittman Hughes, who was a friend and who was married and had kids and was a childcare expert, an African-American woman. I mean, you know, she was everything I was not. And, but, you know, I thought we would make a good team. And also, if I just, you know, failed to be able to keep on, she would go forward. And then after that, when she wanted to stay home with her new baby, Florence Kennedy, remember Florence Kennedy?
Yeah, the great African-American civil rights attorney.
Right. She and I were speaking partners for a long time and several others. So in the beginning of being on the road, we were going out in pairs.
And with Florence Kennedy, you discussed the intersection of racism and sexism,
well,
which is still something that is a hot topic today.
Yes. I mean, we didn't so much discuss it as assume it. You know, I mean, then it was called double jeopardy. Now it's called intersectionality. But what was true then that I think we may not be aware of now is that African-American women were weighed disproportionately in the leadership of the women's movement or in the leadership of ideas, of understanding. I mean, for instance, once Ms. Magazine in an early issue did a Lewis Harris public opinion poll of nationally of women, American women, on women's issues. And it turned out that about 30% of white women were supportive of the movement and the issues of equality, and more than 60% of black women. So, you know, it was just present. And I regret that it's not always been recorded that way, because that renders those women less visible.
I'm speaking with Gloria Steinem, whose book My Life on the Road has just been reissued now in a paperback edition by Random House. You write about meeting a woman biker in South Dakota. Was it gratifying to learn that for her, the women's movement meant that she now rides her own Harley instead of riding behind her husband?
Yes, I thought it was great. I mean, first of all, it was a great lesson in not following your biases, all right, because I looked at all these bikers in this huge rally, thousands and thousands of people. And
most of them supporting Donald Trump, by the way.
Bikers? Do we know bikers have been surveyed as bikers?
Well, there have been a lot of bikers who have shown up whenever they talk about who's supporting Donald Trump.
I wonder.
Oh. Okay.
Because my preconceptions of bikers turned out to be wrong, at least some, you know, quite wrong in this case. Because we, who were there for some Native, Alice Walker and I and Rebecca Adamson, were there for Native American events, and we were kind of avoiding the bikers. And then one day I was sitting in the motel dining room trying to be both cool and unjudgmental in the group of huge number of bikers. And one of the wives with a very improbable hairdo and leather and so on came over to me and said, you know, she said, I really enjoy Ms. Magazine, which just totally knocked me out.
And she knew who you were.
Yes. And not only that, but she said, isn't that woman you're traveling with Alice Walker? So, you know, it's just the road always teaches you not to preconceive. Anyway, so she then, before she left, told me to look out the window in the parking lot and see the purple Harley that was hers. And she explained to me that for a long time in her marriage, she had ridden on the back of her husband's motorcycle, but now finally she had her own. And she said, you know, you should see my grandkids' faces when Grandma drives up on her purple Harley. And she was very proud of it. And it just taught me such a lesson, you know, that we, anyway, I kind of end up saying we all have a purple Harley inside. We just have to get on it and ride.
You said earlier that you spent part of your childhood with your family living in a trailer. Was that during the full year? Didn't your father, Leo Steinem, run a dance pavilion in Michigan every summer?
Yes, he did. So we were there in the summertime. Mm-hmm. But he hated the cold weather. And he also had a small antique business. That is, he would buy antiques at auctions and sell them to roadside shops and so on. So he would do that in the fall. And then he would continue to do that as we drove and made our way in a house trailer to Florida or to California.
And he had to sell the antiques because you say he started out on a long trip with never having enough money to reach the destination?
No, he did. That's quite true. He was a dreamer and an optimist.
Was this always during the Depression, or even?
Well, no.
After the boom times?
Yeah, I was born at the end of the Depression, so this was, during the war and after the war. Right.
If you were traveling, what about school?
That's a good question. My sister, who was 9 years older when we got to Florida or California, would go to school because she needed to do that in order to get into college. But I was young enough, so it didn't matter that much. And I was reading books all the time anyway.
You were homeschooled, in effect?
Yeah, I was book-schooled. Right, mm-hmm. Right.
Did you ever wish that you had a more conventional life when you looked at other kids?
Yes, I think we all do, no? I imagined that one day I would live in a house with a pony and a... And that's partly why it took me a long time to realize, only after I had been on the road a lot in the era of the women's movement and other movements and traveling in that way, did I realize there might be a reason I felt at home doing that, that it had been my childhood.
But it's also kind of like a freelancer's life.
Yes, yes. And my father was the ultimate freelancer, so he prepared me well for for insecurity, right?
You report that in 1957 you had an abortion in England. It was illegal in the United States at the time. What about in England?
It was a tiny bit less illegal in England, but it had to be life-threatening, and you had to have two physicians willing to sign, so it was still extremely difficult, but it was a little less impossible than it was here, which I didn't know at the time, but I happened to find in the phone book a very kind physician who was willing to take a pretty big risk and sign and be the first person who
signed. And say that it was life-threatening.
Yes. I mean, he was not, he was taking a risk, right?
And you dedicated this book to him. Didn't he make you promise to do what you want to do with your life?
Mm-hmm. Yes. It was a lovely... lovely promise, a lovely idea.
And that stayed with you? That stuck with you?
It stayed with me, yes. And later on, I discovered that he had been the physician for the Sitwells, the family of writers.
Edith and...
and Osbert, yeah.
When did you decide to speak publicly about your abortion?
In the first issue of Ms. Magazine, we followed the lead of French feminists who had published a long list of names of women, prominent and otherwise, who said, "I have had an abortion," which was then illegal, "and I demand the repeal of laws that are rendering this criminal and dangerous." That had been done in France, so we followed that in the first issue of Ms. Magazine. So I was asking other people to sign this petition. So clearly I had to sign it too.
Although there are a lot of women who've had abortions, many don't want to have not admitted to that. Why do you think that is?
Well, clearly it's it's like everything else that is supposed to be wrong but is actually common and human, whether it is same-sex love and marriage or... just all kinds of things that society says is wrong, even though it's entirely human.
Was that why you were reluctant to even talk about it until you felt that you had to sign?
Well, yes, because first of all, I had promised the doctor I wouldn't, but also it kind of made you a bad person. We were just narrowly out of the era in which women were supposed to be virgins until they married, much less... anything about abortion. Even though statistically speaking, then as now, 1 in 3 American women has needed an abortion at some time in her life. That statistic has remained pretty much the same. The question is just whether it is life-endangering or legal and safe.
Who were some of the other women who signed?
Oh gosh, there were so many. We would have to look at the list.
But we don't have the time to do that because we're going to go take a little break. But we'll come back with more Gloria Steinem, her book "My Life on the Road," which includes a new chapter, by the way.
Yes, yes, I was able. I'm glad that I was able to put a new chapter into the paperback that I had quite finished in time for the hardcover.
It's published by Random House. We will continue after this. We are back with Gloria Steinem, her book, the first book in a long time, My Life on the Road.
I've been writing, of course, articles and essays along the way, but this is the first book in quite a while.
Now, we mentioned India. You were there actually for 2 years. What were you doing there other than traveling around?
Well, I was kind of fascinated with India because my mother was a theosophist. So I had read, you know, children's books like Lotus Leaves for the Young and so on. And I took a course on India when I was in college, which was relatively rare to have at that time. But it just happened by accident that Chester Bowles, who was then the ambassador, U.S. ambassador to India, came to my college and gave a lecture and left the money, all of $1,000, as a fellowship to go to India. And also, it just happened that I was engaged in my senior year in college and realized that this would not be a good idea. It's a very nice man, but, you know, we were very different. But that I had to go very far away. So all those things, all those accidents of life meant that I went to India to spend a year and loved it and stayed for two.
And then after India, you moved to New York City.
Yes.
Began working as a freelance journalist. You don't include the story of how you were assigned by a magazine to apply for a job at Playboy, because that story's been told so many times.
Yes. Well, this is an on-the-road book, and that was not an on-the-road job. It was just, you know, being a waitress here in the Playboy Club. So I didn't include it here.
Well, that article about the experience made you famous. Did the media often focus on your looks, which were perceived as being too pretty to be a feminist?
Yeah, they did. And even now, as old as I am, and I'm older than you, they still refer to me.
Is that possible?
I would like to comfort you by telling you that it's possible. People still refer to me, especially when they don't like me, as an ex-bunny. So it is a problem. I like to think it was worthwhile because I did change and improve the working conditions of the bunnies by the article, but it's been a bit of a bane as time goes on.
And now Playboy has changed totally, so we move on.
Well, it hasn't changed.
Got rid of the nudes.
Yes, but that's like saying that, how shall I say, that we won't have handguns anymore because there are assault rifles. I mean, you know, their philosophy has not changed.
You were traveling with Gay Talese and Saul Bellow once in a taxi, and you tell that story, what Gay said to Saul about you.
Well, I was freelancing, and I was trying to write an article about Robert Kennedy's campaign for the Senate from New York. And we just happened to be in a taxi together, and I was sitting between them. I had just interviewed Saul Bellow in Chicago for a profile, but it hadn't come out yet. And as I was talking about something else entirely, about how one could get Robert Kennedy, who was a completely authentic person, I have to say, he found it very difficult to answer a question when he knew you knew the answer. He would just say, you know that.
So that would be lousy for a radio interview.
Right. So I was explaining to them what had been explained to me, that what you had to do was bring along somebody Bobby disagreed with, and then he would talk, and then you would get lots of quotes. So as I was in the middle of explaining what I thought was a helpful thing, Gay Talese kind of leaned across me and said to Saul Bellow, you know how every year there's a pretty girl who comes to New York and pretends to be a writer? Gloria is this year's pretty girl. I was, my first impulse was that I was worried that Saul Bellow would be sorry that he'd given me an interview, since I was not a real writer. And only after I got out of the taxi did I realize I should have been mad on the spot and objected at the in the moment. And I was angry at myself for not doing it. You know, the interesting...
Have you spoken to Gay about that since?
Well, what happened was I put this in the book because I knew it was true. And though the book is fact-checked, I didn't call because I wasn't convinced that he... I just didn't know what would happen. But The New Yorker, when they did something about the book, included that quote. And they called him, and he said yes. He said that.
And right. That's it. Well, he had he's had his own problems recently because of his most recent.
Well, problem. You know, to be fair to him, I think in his it's quite possible that in his mind, calling me a pretty girl was so wonderful that the rest didn't matter.
Yeah, but you say saying you were the flavor of the week.
Yeah, right, and that I wasn't a real writer. That was the most hurtful.
You were asked in 1968 to join the editorial board of New York Magazine, so somebody thought you were a writer. How'd you feel about being the only woman working with all of those accomplished men, Pete Hamill, Jimmy Breslin, Tom Wolfe?
Mm-hmm. And Clay Felker, who had been my editor at Esquire and a wonderful editor, really innovative and wonderful.
The creator of New York Magazine.
Yeah, the creator of New York Magazine. You know, at that moment in time, I was kind of used to it, you know, being the only girl writer. There was also, do you remember a show called That Was the Week That Was?
Mm-hmm,
it
sure.
was the pioneer
very funny
satire show on television. I didn't do much for it, but I was also the only girl writer there. So it wasn't so unusual, and there was not yet a women's movement saying, wait a minute, you know, why is this true?
But hadn't Simone de Beauvoir's The Second Sex already been published?
Yes, it had been, and very important. But somehow it was distant enough and intellectual enough so that, and lacking enough in American examples so that it wasn't as important in starting a movement as one might have wished.
My guest is Gloria Steinem. Her book, My Life on the Road, updated, has just been published in a paperback edition by Random House's WMIC, WMIC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. The women's movement initially, you mentioned that a lot of African-American women associated themselves with feminism, but it was seen as a white middle-class movement.
They didn't associate themselves with feminism. They were feminism.
Okay, but it was perceived as a white middle-class movement.
Which was crazy. I mean, Fannie Lou Hamer was a great pioneer in coming forward and talking about reproductive rights, because she was talking about having been sterilized without her knowledge or permission when she went into a Mississippi hospital for something else. Johnny Tillman, who was part of the National Welfare Rights Organization, had done a funny, brilliant look at welfare policy as a gigantic husband that, you know, looked under your bed for shoes of other men and kept you on a short leash of money. And so it was quite I think, as far as I know, it was the first feminist analysis of social policy. Flo Kennedy, you know, was a pioneer feminist. So, you know, black women were always doing it in probably, according to public opinion polls, greater proportion than white women. But either because of just sheer racism in the media, or because... Also because of racism, white women's books were more likely to get published, I suppose. And also, I think, to be divisive, frankly, you know, to denigrate the women's movement. It was spoken of as a white middle-class movement.
Because when I think of the names that we generally heard in connection with that, Simone de Beauvoir, of course, but also Bella Abzug and you, and none of the names that you have just mentioned.
I know. Well, this has been a problem over time. And now with two friends who are African-American feminists of great standing, we're trying to do a book, about a friendly book saying, you know, here are black women who invented feminism.
Were you inspired by Clay Felker's creation of New York Magazine to be one of the people who started Ms. in 1972?
Yes, no, absolutely. It taught me how to start a magazine. Not that there's only one way, but it taught me it was possible, let me put it that way, to start a new magazine. And it made me understand that even a terrific, lively, engaging magazine that New York was not going to be speaking about or for or from the women's movement.
And when you look back to the early years of that publication, do you find that a lot of the articles would be just as relevant today? I'm thinking of one that you wrote called If Men Could Menstruate.
Yes, right. Actually, that is newly booming, that article, because in a way you may have noticed in the past year or so, menstruation has come out of the closet. You know, that there, Newsweek had a whole cover that said there will be blood or something. Mm-hmm. And one of the marathon runners was running while menstruating. I mean, it's sort of come out in the open in a way. So now this may be the single thing I've ever written in my life that that is the most read.
Well, it's good to have things reprinted. Wasn't there, you mentioned Bobby Kennedy, wasn't there some ill will among your friends who endorsed Bobby Kennedy that year when you were supporting Jean McCarthy? The two candidates had a lot in common.
Yeah, they did. And I think you and I both probably remember this kind of as a tough time because Robert Kennedy had been asked to run before Eugene McCarthy. Eugene McCarthy was not the first choice of the peace movement that was going around asking people, but he was the first person who said yes.
Well, there were a lot of people who, on the left, who were uncomfortable with Bobby Kennedy because he'd had that experience with Joe McCarthy, and they weren't sure that they could trust him.
Well, I think by then he'd kind of proven himself, I mean, as in terms of his change of heart and change of politics. I don't know. I'm sure different people had different feelings. But the fact that Eugene McCarthy had been there in New Hampshire, in the snows of New Hampshire, and that he was this silver-haired poet from Minnesota, you know, was very influential to me, too. You know, so I had volunteered to help to write his campaign materials. And it was only when a group of us as writers went to interview him for those, you know, campaign subjects. And he said to us things like, well, okay, but don't talk about the war because New Hampshire is a hawk state. Mm-hmm. And we said, but wait a minute, you know, this is the heart of your campaign. I mean, he was so autocratic and... you know, he just wasn't what we expected at all. So I began to realize maybe we needed to think again.
But that kind of ill will has occurred again and again. Didn't something similar happen this year between supporters of Hillary and Bernie? And as you point out, between Clinton and Obama supporters in 2008?
Mm-hmm. Yes, yeah, yeah. No, it can be very painful. You know, it's one thing to find oneself opposed to people who really, truly, sincerely disagree on the issues. It's something else to find oneself opposed to people you agree with. It's much more painful.
This year, you generated a bit of controversy when you appeared on the Bill Maher Show and said that young women supported Bernie Sanders so that they could meet young men.
But I did not say that.
What did you say?
Thank you for bringing that up because it drives me crazy. I had just, on the show, I had just been talking about young women being angry about graduating in huge debt, mm-hmm. and getting paid $1 million less over a lifetime to pay the debt back. So I was on the way to say, it was the first half of a sentence, I was on my way to saying that when you're young, you think that, you know, where the guys are, where the power is, not about dates, but about getting free universal education. So, but Bill interrupted me in the middle of the sentence. It was so far from what I was heading for that I didn't even get, you know, he was saying, oh, you know, how tough it would be if he said that. And I was sitting there saying, what, what? You know, how well do you know me? You know, that wasn't what I meant.
It was a real show.
Education, though.
That show where people talk over each other all the time. You're never sure what people really intended
but
to
say. But
it
was, in the end, it was extremely painful to be thought to be saying something I never would say. But it was a good education because it helped me understand what happens at Twitter length, you know, when something is out there that is deceptive, that seems to be saying something you didn't say.
Do you still frequently travel to college campuses for speaking engagements?
Yes, very.
And what kind of feedback are you getting from young people?
You know, I think there's a real resurgence of activism now, thanks to Black Lives Matter, which is crucial and was founded by three young African-American women, thanks to real discontent with the economic division in this country, which Bernie Sanders was very eloquent in talking about, and thanks to a new resurgence of very, very activist feminism on the web and in the streets. You know, and I hope and believe now there's much more understanding that sexism and racism, for instance, can really only be uprooted together because they're so intertwined. One can't really continue without the other.
You have a friendship with Wilma Mankiller, which always struck me as not necessarily the best name for a feminist. But
well, shall I explain her name?
She's the first elected chief of the Cherokee Nation.
Yes, for two terms. Should have been president of the country, an extraordinary woman. When asked about her name, seriously, she would explain that it was a title, and it had once been White Man Killer. Mm-hmm. It was a title for someone who protected the village. When asked unseriously, she would say, I earned it.
Just one other thing. Are there new issues? Or, for example, the ERA never was passed.
Yes, no, we need, and a lot of the arguments against it are gone. You know, the arguments of that bathrooms would be integrated or that women would be in combat or that there would be same-sex marriage, you know, all of which happened anyway, with or without, you know.
Although they're still being debated today.
Yes, but, you know, and we still very much need it because the standard of scrutiny, of constitutional scrutiny for discrimination is still not as high for sex discrimination. So we still definitely need it. But I think what's happening now that's long overdue and exciting is that the issues that used to be viewed in silos, you know, that there were racial issues, women's issues, environmental issues, foreign policy issues, are now being seen as connected. So we're beginning to understand, for instance, that the single biggest indicator of whether a country in this world is violent inside itself or will be violent against another country militarily is not poverty or access to natural resources or religion or even degree of democracy. It's violence against females.
Gloria Steinem's My Life on the Road was a New York Times bestseller when it was released in hardcover, now available in paperback with a new chapter. It is published by Random House. Thank you so much for being on our show.
Thank you so much. And thank you so much for being here. Thank you for longevity.
I appreciate that. And you too. We both had a lot of longevity.